as real estate, I think, usually goes, it's location, location, location.
Welcome to the 14th episode of our deep dive series on Canadian bank earnings. Today, we're covering the first quarter 2024 bank earnings announcements, and we're going to be returning each quarter on this channel to update you on the latest financial results. My name is Daniel Stanley. I'm an ETF specialist at BMO Exchange Traded Funds, and I'm joined today by my friends and colleagues, Chris Heeks, portfolio manager for all of BMO's equity and multi-asset ETFs, and Sohrab Movahedi, managing director of financials research at BMO Capital Markets. Today, we're going to cover the recent bank earnings announcements and what they mean for investors and the Canadian economy, as well as looking at different ETF strategies that give you exposure to the Canadian banks. So without further ado, gentlemen, Chris and Sohrab, thank you for taking the time to join me. And Sohrab, as we often do, I want to start with you. Look, the Canadian economy, while no one's talking about being in recession, growth certainly doesn't seem to be there. And that seems to be setting some expectations for the banks fairly low, and in particular heading into this earnings season. How did the banks do this earnings season?
So I'd say we started fiscal 2024, so we would have just reported the first quarter results, in a little bit of a better than worried. How does that sound? So what I mean by that is we were probably looking for the system-wide earnings year over year to be down around 10%. They reported actually something in the order of magnitude of $14.1 billion for the quarter in after-tax earnings. And that was down about 8% from a year ago. So a little bit less than what we would, a little bit better, I suppose. Still $14 billion in earnings. I mean, I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that they are profitable. And I suspect we are lapping, I'll call it, more difficult comps. You know, when we look at these growth and we're comparing them to prior years, I think we're coming close to lapping these more difficult comps in the next quarter. I'm gonna stick my neck out here a little bit and say probably another quarter where we may see negative earnings growth, still positive, obviously, earnings, but from a comparability perspective, but likely to see that turn now and probably turn positive, certainly by Q3 when we look at the year-over-year stuff and into the year-end and certainly into 2025. I'd say that, when you look at our reaction, let's say, to the results, you know, we tweaked estimates a little bit up and down, generally up, down for TD. But in totality, we didn't really think of the quarter as material in terms of revisions to estimates, nor did we view it as material in terms of revisions to valuation multiples.
No, thanks for that, Sohrab. And I love that emphasis on the fact that they still had $14 billion of earnings, which, you know, as Canadians who are invested in banks, whether it's through the individual securities or through the ETF or through mutual funds, that those dividends that are churned out from that are in a good position. Chris, I want to transition over to you because, we tend to spend some time watching the individual bank stocks. Maybe can you talk a little bit about how the individual bank stocks reacted to those Q1 earnings announcements? And how did that compare to, the performance of ZEB, which is the BMO Equal Weight Bank ETF?
Yeah, $14 billion, that's a lot. As our good friend Brian Belsky in Capital Markets says, billions with a B. So that's big numbers. Yeah, in terms of the price action, it was generally positive. So, as a reminder, last quarter, we saw really around earnings, the best kind of price action we'd seen in terms of upwards price action on banks in kind of a few quarters. The average bank on their earnings announcement day moved about 1.7%. And in Q4, and there were several that were 3, 4, 5%. A little more muted this quarter, but still positive. So you had Commerce and National both moved up 2%. Bank of Nova Scotia moved up 3%, and they were the big laggard in Q4. They look like the market's becoming more receptive to some of the changes that are happening there. Unfortunately for us, and on the call, BMO was the laggard, down 3%. And we have been up 2% in the last quarter, but, net, the average, bank was up about approximately, 1% on the quarter. And, just a little more on the price action, for ZEB now, which is, as you mentioned, the BMO Canadian Equal Weight Banks ETF, we're up about 1.6% for the year. It had really rallied into the earnings announcements as well as out of. So I think that's a nice thing to see from a price perspective. Banks kind of started the year a little bit negative, but from mid-February, we're up about 5%. And so mid-February was about 2 weeks before earnings, and then now we're a couple of weeks on the other side of earnings. So, in general, I think these trends are pretty positive. It's nice to hear what Sohrab said in terms of, well, we don't like being down 8% at a bank, but being down 8 is better than down 10. So that's certainly nice to hear. I think there's been some favorable macro trends, which have really been the difference makers to equities in general. Going back to last November, where, the Fed started talking about interest rate cuts a little bit more, and then the market really became more constructive around a no landing or a very soft landing scenario. So certainly that's helped broad markets and banks, north and south of the border as well. So, that's part of it. But always great to see positive momentum. And a lot of times in equity investing, positive momentum, momentum tends to carry through. So we'll see how that evolves, but a good start to the year.
Yeah, no, that's great, Chris. Thank you. And you're right about the macro. And it certainly helps being a neighbor to the United States with the growth in their U.S. economy. And that sort of bodes well for the Canadian banks for sure. Sohrab, I want to come back to you here because, your thesis last quarter was that the Canadian banks were at this inflection point and that 2023 was going to be that year that everyone wants to forget. And you've kind of alluded to that, but maybe given what you saw and heard last week, does 2024 look to be a better year? And if so, why?
Look, I think 2024, certainly with the benefit of the first quarter results, actual results, and obviously management commentary and the outlook that they're providing, I think the thesis we shared with you is still intact. We are probably, it's always hard to say, well, December ended, January started, so we're in 24. I would say there's always a little bit of these don't shift, they transition. What did we get this quarter, which I think is encouraging and supportive of the thesis we had provided? Number one, for example, a number of the banks have discounts on their dividend reinvestment programs as a way of issuing shares to basically shore up their capital levels for regulatory requirement purposes and for obviously for when you're downside focused, you want to have higher capital levels. Well, they've indicated at least three of the four banks have given us the actual dates they're going to turn those discounts off, and the fourth one is likely to do it when they report their results next quarter, as far as giving us a date. That's a net positive because we're now, capital levels are not continuously grinding higher. Certainly, we've had, and we talked about this last quarter, the regulator is not pushing the domestic stability buffer any higher. That's a net positive. In the context of regulatory peer pressure, yesterday we got a sense out of the U.S. that maybe the suggested Basel III endgame is not going to be implemented with the same kind of voracity and severity as it was implied in the U.S. I think that takes a little bit of regulatory peer pressure off. So I think capital levels, just so that we're here in Canada, we're targeting 11.5 from a regulatory minimum perspective. The banks were well clear of that, 12.5 to 13.5%, even after you pro forma, for example, Royal Bank for the pending HSBC acquisition, and you take a placeholder for some of the charges that penalty that TD is likely going to have to pay for its issues. So I would say capital, not a concern. And, you know, we got indications that we may be near the peak of reserve building in anticipation of future credit losses. Now, remember that under IFRS 9, which was implemented in 2018, the banks are now on a proactive or pro-cyclical basis, adding to their reserves, whereas historically, credit may have been more of a lagging indicator. We may have seen re-ratings on the banks after we had seen the peak of the provisioning. I think we're starting to see the peak of the provisioning, and I think investors should take note that those provisionings are happening probably on average a year earlier than they would have historically because of some accounting changes. You know, CIBC, as an example, would have been a leading indicator of commercial real estate and office commercial real estate in the U.S. in particular. They were early reserve builders, and they would be the one of the ones that suggested that, you know, knowing what they know about their portfolio, obviously it's idiosyncratic to their portfolio, they believe that reserve building is materially behind them, for example, as far as the U.S. office commercial real estate portfolio is concerned. So this doesn't mean to say that we won't see headlines around bankruptcies or Canadian consumer leverage or what have you. But if we are indeed in a bit of a soft landing type scenario, which I think has become consensus, and we are going to have rate cuts, and we believe our economics department has a June kind of as a first rate cut, and so call it back half of the year, we see the pressures around credit quality and reserving in anticipation of impairments lessening, okay? So we then think you can start transitioning your views into top-line growth, into revenue-driven pre-tax, pre-provision growth, and ultimately start talking about higher ROEs again. And, you know, I can't promise you we're there yet. I think everything we've seen would suggest we are very close to that point. And in fact, we would argue that investors should start thinking, you know, about the transition towards more offense, less defense, so to speak, as it were, with respect to their bank holdings and their portfolios.
Or to use, I guess, another analogy, Sourabh, it's the headwinds of reserve building, the headwinds of regulatory issues that I know when we spoke roughly around this time last year, after what happened in the U.S., you said that one of the worries was that the hangover of regulatory peer pressure. So it sounds like what you're saying, in effect, is that the headwinds of these two issues are sort of possibly behind us, and that we can focus on the tailwinds of looking at that top line growth, which is really exciting. Chris, I want to come over to you now, because in addition to ZEB, we also have ZWB, the BMO covered call Canadian bank ETF. For those who want income, we've also got ZBI, the Canadian bank income index ETF, for those who want bonds and pref shares. And then more recently, we launched ZEBA, which is the Canadian bank accelerator ETF. For those who are basically bullish on the Canadian banks and want a little bit of greater upside with a cap. So I'm curious, Chris, given the conditions that you've sort of heard Sourabh describe, is there any one of those particular ETFs or a mix of ETFs that you'd look to, given what you've heard?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And I thought it would, I thought it would be interesting and productive to talk a little bit about ZBI, the Canadian Banking Income ETF, because this is really more of a fixed income tool. And we're obviously talking about equities when we're talking about banks. But, you know, as investors, we generally have fixed income as well as equities to diversify, you know, the overall portfolio. We launched this fund about 2 years ago. I think it's fair to say it hasn't been a huge star to the gate. But what I would argue now is we're starting to see the value of the strategy. And we're seeing a much more constructive, banks movement in the last few months. And it's translating on the fixed income side of the portfolio as well. So just to kind of very briefly, you know, what is in the portfolio? It's all big six banks, bonds and preferred shares. So it's about 60% bonds And they tend to be tilted towards the shorter end, so kind of between 0 and 10 years of maturity. And then 40% hybrid instruments like preferred shares. What the hybrid instruments do is they allow that income to increase. There's higher yield on the preferred shares versus the bonds. You're looking at a yield to maturity on this product of about 5.6%. And for a couple of bond comparables, ZAG, our BMO aggregate bond index ETF. So the aggregate bond universe in Canada, you're about 4.3% YTM. If you just look at corporate bonds, you know, banks are obviously corporate bonds. You know, you get a bit of a pickup, you're at 4.9. But again, with the Canadian Bank Income ETF, you're at 5.6. What are the advantages of the bonds? Obviously, bonds in general carry less volatility than equities as well. So the 1 year volatility of this bond ETF is about 5%. It's kind of in line with fixed income, right? It's a fixed income exposure. ZEB would have 15%. That's an equity level of risk. So it's about a third of that mark-to-market risk. And, you know, I found it quite interesting on a one-year perspective, which obviously there's been a lot of, you know, it's hard to remember everything that's happened in a year, but there's been, you know, certainly lots of ups and downs, and we kind of expect that going forward. Canadian banks were on the equity side doing pretty poorly to start the year last year and into the middle of the year, and then really had that kind of renaissance in Q4 and kind of carrying over into this year. But on a one-year basis, the return of ZBI is almost 8%, 7.9. And if you look at ZEB, it's about 5%. So I'm not going to suggest that bonds, you would expect them to give more return over the long period of time, but in certain environments, they can be very effective, especially when equities aren't doing as well. So, you know, if we're arguing for the benefits of banks, I think as an investor, you can consider, okay, obviously we're considering banks on the equity side of the portfolio. You know, what can they do on the fixed income side of the portfolio as well? So, I think it's actually a very good product. It's really showing some merits, you know, now as we get into our third year of this product, being out into the market. And so I think that's a very interesting one to have on your portfolio. You know, I in general would advocate for a tilt to banks over time because of, you know, that it tends to give a richer return over time. And again, that can help on the fixed income as well as the equity. And just want to spend a bit of time there, you know, on the equity side, just to echo, given the conditions, you know, Sohrab outlined, in terms of playing offense, you know, I think that's ZEB is your best tool. It's simple, it's effective, equities, very low management fee, all in one package, rebalances twice a year. That's going to be a very effective tool to play offense. You know, of course, if you are an income investor, income oriented investor, the ZWB is always a great tool. It gives you more income, a little less growth. But, you know, I think for a lot of investors still playing in the total return space, you know, Keep it simple, as they say, and ZEB is a great tool to do that on the equity side.
Thanks for that, Chris. I think it's timely, certainly with the next question I want to ask Sohrab, but again, I think we tend to forget that the banks are big bond issuers and it's high quality corporate debt in effect. And at a 5.6% yield to maturity, it can be attractive. Sohrab, it's a great segue into my next question for you, because we've talked about the different, you know, the difference between risks to the balance sheet, risks to the income statement. And I've seen this talked about a little bit more in the news lately. Can you just give us a quick overview of those risks and which are sort of more or less serious when it comes to the Canadian banks at this point in this cycle?
Whenever we're going through a bit of a downturn, and I'm talking about an economic downturn, I mean, these are balance sheet intensive businesses. We all know that. They make money by taking deposits and making loans. So, when economic risk increases, when risk of, economic contraction increases, they're like, you know, the worry is not every loan made under certain assumptions is going to be, you know, be made good, right? So what we worry about usually with the balance sheet risk is, hey, do they have enough good loans? Have they adequately allowed for potential loan losses? And do they have the earnings to absorb? Because earnings and income statement will be your first line of defense, really, when you have hits coming at you. So when you think about that, you know, obviously Canadian consumer leverage is a concern. A very large portion of the system-wide balance sheet is Canadian mortgages. We certainly have had to absorb, or when I say we, clients or investors, or mortgage holders have had to absorb a relative rate shock, right? In other words, if you were in a variable rate mortgage and your rates are going up, there's a tendency to feel the pain of that. Now, some banks would have had the feature that allowed you to adjust your amortization period to maintain your monthly payments. A couple of the banks would not have had that feature. But long and short of it is, the measures that are in the system, ultimately, I think, in place from a bank shareholder perspective, for the banks to get their money back, right? Like we're not in a rush to write off loans if we can, you know, rehabilitate the borrower, if we could work with that borrower. And when I say we, I mean the banks, obviously, to work with the borrowers. And it certainly looks like those measures have gone according to plan, right? So we've extended, the banks have extended amortizations, but clients have been able to then also make good on the promises they've made as far as the reject kind of loan terms. I mean, I think a saving grace, let's be honest here, has been that the employment picture has remained still constructive. So, you know, reminder again that if people are working, they don't want to, they're not looking to default on their debt. And so, as I say, like when we look at some of the broad stroke stuff, and it's been a tough year, right? Like, I mean, when you think about this increase in rates and the pressure it would have put on the business of lending at the same time that it would have put pressure on the business of deposits, right? Like, and squeeze some of the margin that some of the banks are making. Like, some of this has been largely absorbed. And, you know, for people like me, people some like you guys that are in the capital markets, we also know that we have experienced a prolonged period of subdued activity in capital markets businesses. These are important parts of the revenues for the bank. So when you think about the income statement, we've had a little bit of pressure, if you will, on credit provisioning, probably not enough support coming from fee businesses when you think back over the last, call it 12 months or 12 to 24 months. And you've had this, you know, economic contraction worry, which probably has subdued loan growth demand or loan demand, which kind of weighs on loan growth. We've had some, we're going through this transition in rates, which has implications for cost of borrowing and credit spreads. Much of that, I can't say 100% of that is done, but we've absorbed a lot of that. And as we look ahead, we expect loan growth is going to remain subdued, but we expect fee businesses, whether it's wealth, whether it's capital markets, some of those things we're going to start picking up. And ultimately, a bit of a more favorable rate environment, consistent maybe with a bit of a more favorable economic backdrop, if you want to call it the soft landing type scenario, something that avoids the, you know, the infamous kind of recession or, you know, the big leg down. I think all of that lessens the risk on balance sheet, lessens the concern on the downside, and starts to transition the focus to the upside. And so if some of these revenues we're talking about come through, the banks obviously took restructuring charges late last year. Some of the benefits are of those are going to come through probably towards the second half of this year and into 2025. So that will manage expenses. You should be able to get operating leverage without the headwinds of credit reserve building coming at you. You have a reasonably good setup and obviously easier comps. I know it's 14 billion, but it's down, right? So, you know, easier comps will allow for a bit more growth. And so, like I said, I don't want to pound the table, but I think there are reasons consistent with the thesis we had talked, you know, probably over the last quarter as well, to start feeling a little bit more optimistic on the outlook here.
That's great, Sourabh, because the news tends to be less focused on the optimistic side. But again, I go back to that. These are you know, companies that have $14 billion of earnings, they pay a healthy dividend. And so it's nice to hear that we're a little bit more optimistic in the future. So guys, I want to finish up. Normally I ask both of you one question, but I'm going to close things off. Chris, I want to start with one question for you, because it was almost exactly a year ago that we had all those problems with the U.S. regional banks. You know, how does, fast forward a year, you know, how does that U.S. banking sector look 1 year later? And, you know, what has there been any spillover to Canada, if any?
Yeah, thanks. I'll start with the U.S. and I'll put some comments in. Yeah, Sourav can add on and talk about the spillover to Canada. But, you know, in terms of what we've seen in the U.S., certainly better. I mean, to start with that, it's a lot better than it was a year ago. You know, obviously that was a significant drawdown in U.S. banks, and they've been digging out of the hole. So ZUB, which is the BMO U.S. bank hedge to CAD ETF, is up about 39% since mid-March a year ago when all that was happening. I think it's worthy to note that there's another bank that's going through some stuff, but, you know, it looks like the market has jumped through it and contained it. So this was the NYCB, New York Commercial Bank. I understand it was mostly commercial loans, perhaps real estate. I'm not sure the exact nature, but a hedge fund came in and bailed them out. So that looks isolated, you know, in general, much more constructive. I think those macro tailwinds, you know, that were mentioned, I think, you know, have obviously been super constructive. And then, you know, just to echo on Sourav, you know, in terms of risks, you know, the economy is the largest risk to the banks, and especially south of the border, I think. And so this, you know, idea that we're getting a soft landing or no landing is certainly constructive. And you know, given they sold off a lot, you know, a lot of times that gives room on the upside after a large sell-off like we saw last year. So generally constructive. You know, Sourav also mentioned the regulatory easement that the Powell was speaking about yesterday. Obviously, that's always constructive as well. So there's some constructive trends. You know, the risks that remain, you know, obviously it's the economy, I think, is the big one. And that'll have to be gauged and monitored going forward. We're seeing a little bit of a higher for longer in terms of interest rate policy that's being messaged by the Fed. Now equity investors haven't reacted overly to this, but you wonder if that persists. You know, does that take some of the shine off of a possible no landing? Because I think, you know, higher for longer will naturally play into more of a landing, you know, harder landing, right? Potentially.
Certainly, they've got the advantage of the U.S. economic growth engine, which just seems to be trucking along. It's impressive. Sourav, I want to end off with you. Your thoughts on an issue that has been top of mind for a lot of people. You know, we're hearing about from the Canadian banks, and just talk to us about Canadian banks and their outlook for commercial real estate.
Yeah, I mean, I think commercial real estate has a broad theme. You know, I think all the banks, whether north or south of the border, certainly Canadian banks would disaggregate commercial real estate between at least, you know, office, multifamily, industrial. And I think the pocket of commercial real estate that has been obviously attracting a lot of the attention has been the U.S. office commercial real estate. Just to put things into kind of some perspective, broader commercial real estate portfolio of the Canadian banks, this would be their global portfolios, primarily US and Canada, maybe represents about 10% of their overall loan book. And of that, maybe one, depending on the bank, 1 to 2% of the loan book may be in office, US office commercial real estate. So I think, and as real estate, I think usually goes, you know, it's location, location, location. I think a lot of the banks will tell you that, you know, two buildings across the street from each other could have different, you know, capital structures, different, you know, the age of the building will matter. There's a variety of things that factor in. I think what matters is what I kind of alluded to a little bit earlier, that if CIBC was the leading indicator here, they are now telling us that for their portfolio, which probably had enough of the regionals, the risky regions of the U.S. in it, they're telling us that having gone through the renewal cycle, like I said, for most of it, nearly half of it, they feel like they have been able to assess the risks in a way that they feel comfortable that they've reserved and provided for them. So I think commercial real estate, office commercial real estate, for example, and generally speaking, again, I'm not trying to declare victory on credit, but I think as far as the implications of credit quality, degradation in credit portfolio and need for reserve building is going to increasingly become a rear view mirror item for the banks. If it's not next quarter, then it will be the quarter after that. But for the most part, the reserve building, whether it's for consumer credit in Canada, whether it's for negative amortizing mortgages, or whether it's for credit cards, or whether it's for auto loans, or whether it's for commercial real estate, I think the Canadian banks have been reserving at a pace that makes us feel comfortable they are adequate. I'm not suggesting they're over-reserved. We're suggesting they're adequately reserved for the economic backdrop that we are planning on, which is this kind of call it softish lending type scenario.
That's a great way to end. At the end of the day, they're doing a good job of managing those reserves and irrespective of the environment that they can't control. And I think that's a great way to close off our discussion today. Chris and Saurabh, thank you very, very much. Like I said, I always love to love these sessions. We get some true facts on what's going on the ground with the banks. As a reminder to the audience, you can get exposure to the Canadian banks via ZEB, which is the BMO Equal Weight Banks Index ETF. You can get exposure to our U.S. banks ETF, which is ZUB, ZBK, the BMO Equal Weight U.S. Banks Index ETF. If you have any questions, please visit the ETF Center at BMOETFS.com. That's all for today, folks. Thank you for tuning in. Please join us for our next session when we update you on Canadian bank earnings.
Views from the Desk has been brought to you by BMO Global Asset Management.
The viewpoints expressed by the portfolio managers represent their assessment of the markets at the time of publication. Those views are subject to change without notice at any time without any kind of notice. The information contained herein is not and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice to any party. Investments should be evaluated relative to the individual's investment objectives, and professional advice should be obtained with respect to any circumstance. Any statement that necessarily depends on future events may be a forward-looking statement. Forward-looking statements are not guarantees of performance. Commissions, management fees, and expenses, if any, all may be associated with investments in exchange-traded funds. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus before investing. Exchange-traded funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently and past performance may not be repeated. BMO Global Asset Management is a brand name under which BMO Asset Management, Inc. and BMO Investments, Inc. operate.